Nicole left her house in New Eden's southeast village of Beauvoir, a name she had chosen because it had been the name of her father's villa in France. In fact, Nicole had designed the house in New Eden to be a smaller version of her ancestral home. She walked down the narrow lane in the direction of the train station. She passed the other houses, all dark and empty, and tried to imagine what it would be like when they were full of people. Shadows were cast on the lane as the simulated sun completed its arc in the ceiling far above her head. "Another remarkable world," Nicole mused, surveying the village. "The eagle was correct when he said that the habitat would be indistinguishable from Earth." Nicole walked through the village park, past a rock circumference containing a playground. Underneath her feet, the network of gas exchange devices, or GEDs, was interweaved through portions of the park that would eventually contain the grasses brought from Earth. Nicole bent down to examine the ingenious GEDs. Several thousand of the tiny devices were arrayed in rows and columns that crisscrossed the park. Electronic plants, Nicole thought, converting carbon dioxide to oxygen, making it possible for us animals to survive. She left the park, continuing toward the station, and boarded the waiting train just behind the control cab that was manned by one of the human biots whose function it was to relieve the colonists of drudgery. 5 easily recognizable types of biots had been manufactured so that colonists would never mistake a biot for a human being. In this case, the conductor was a biot that had been created in the image of Benita Garcia. "How long to the somnarium?" Nicole asked. "Just a couple of minutes," Benita told her. The train ride took her from Beauvoir in the southeast corner to the colony's geographic center, where the hospital was located. Arriving at the hospital, Nicole walked through a long tunnel to the somnarium, which was an extension of the hospital that held enough sleeping berths to accommodate the anticipated 2,000 habitat residents. Each member of Nicole's family was asleep there now in a hermetically sealed coffin-like berth. As she had been trained to do by the eagle, Nicole examined the monitors displaying the data about the physical condition of her husband, her 2 daughters, and her 2 sons. Nicole gazed at each of her loved ones and then lingered for several minutes beside Richard's berth. He had been the last to go to sleep 2 days before. He had taken Prince Hal and Falstaff into the berth with him, and they were lying on his chest. According to the procedure, since everyone's critical parameters were well within tolerances, it was now time for Nicole to go to sleep herself. She climbed into her berth and closed it. The foam was unbelievably comfortable. Now she had only to trip the final switch to bring the sleeping gas into her compartment. "Mrs. Wakefield." The voice seemed far, far away. It intruded gently into her consciousness, but it didn't awaken her completely. "Mrs. Wakefield." Nicole tried to recall where she was before opening her eyes. Slowly, her memory began to work again. "New Eden, inside Rama, back to the solar system. Is this all just a dream?" She finally opened her eyes, and the figure bending over her resolved itself. It was her mother, dressed in a nurse's uniform. "Mrs. Wakefield, it is now time to wake up and prepare for the rendezvous." For a moment, Nicole was in a state of shock. Where was she? What was her mother doing here? Then she remembered. Mother is one of the 5 kinds of human robots. An Anoe Diaso robot is a health and fitness specialist. This one was an Anoe Diaso number 017. Her number was stamped on her uniform. Nicole sat up in her berth. Her muscles did not feel strange at all. She remembered the eagle informing her that each sleeping compartment included special electronic components to exercise the muscles and other biological systems to preclude atrophy. "Where are we, number 017? "We have completed the major deceleration profile and entered your solar system. Mars orbit insertion will be in 6 months. Richard was awakened next. He was clearly delighted to see his wife. "None the worse for wear," he said jokingly, after staring at her for several seconds. The gray in your hair has spread, but there are still clotches of black in isolated spots. He gave her a long hug and a kiss. Nicole took Richard's hand and went to Patrick's berth. The face she saw through the window was astonishing. Her little Patrick was no longer a boy. The rounded contours of his face had disappeared, and his features had lengthened. His age equivalent is 16 or 17, Tiasso number 017 said in response to Nicole's questioning glance. Nicole and Richard stopped at each of the other berths and stared through the windows at their sleeping children. Nicole repeatedly shook her head in bewilderment. "Where have all my babies gone?" she said after seeing that even little Ellie had become a teenager during the long voyage. By the time they were 6 weeks away from Mars, almost everyone in the family had adjusted to having suddenly awakened in a different stage of life. Katie, however, was having problems, and she finally brought one of her major concerns to Nicole. "You know, Mother, the Eagle must have made some kind of mistake with the controls in my berth. I think I must have received some of the hormones that were meant for Patrick and Benji. My body's just too boyish." "Katie, darling," Nicole replied, "it is virtually certain that you have become the person your genes were programmed to be at conception. You are a lovely, intelligent young woman. You would be happier if you didn't spend your time finding imperfections in yourself and wishing to be somebody different. Why don't you try to concentrate on your studies, like Ellie?" This exchange was similar to many of the conversations they'd had since awakening. To Katie, it seemed that her mother did not try to understand her. "There's more to life than just feeling good," was a regular refrain sounding in Katie's ears. At the same time, she thought her mother's praise for Ellie was effusive. "First Simone, now Ellie," Katie thought. "I've never had a chance with Mother. We're just too different. I might as well stop trying." Two months later, Rama had made repeated orbits around Mars, and there was still no sign of the contingent from Earth. Nicole had always assumed that their rendezvous with their fellow humans would take place immediately after Mars orbit insertion. In truth, the entire family was getting edgy. Often after dinner, they would all go out into Richard's small backyard observatory to look at Mars. One evening, Benji asked, "Where is Earth?" "I want to see Earth." It was a simple enough request. It had just never occurred to Richard that the children might be interested in that barely blue light in the Martian night sky. Once he had identified the Earth for them, the children all stared with rapt attention. "That is their home planet, even though they have never been there," Nicole thought. She became aware of a profound longing deep within her to return to Earth. Tears welled up in her eyes as she moved closer to Benji and put her arms around him. "Wherever we go in this amazing universe," she said softly to all the children, "both now and in the future, that blue speck will always be our home." Kilometers from Earth, newlyweds Kenji and Nai Watanabe gazed out from a porthole upon the blue planet around which their spaceship, the Penta, was orbiting. "I never fully realized," Nai said to her husband, "just what it meant to be in geosynchronous orbit. The Earth doesn't move from here. It looks suspended in space." Kenji laughed. "Actually, we're both moving, and very fast. But our orbital period and the Earth's rotation period are the same, so the Earth always presents us with the same picture." "Damn," they heard someone behind them shout. They turned to see a husky young man in a plaid shirt and blue jeans flailing around, suspended in the air, and on the other side of the observation lounge. Kenji crossed over and helped the newcomer to stand upright on his feet. "Thanks," the man said. "I forgot to keep one foot on the floor at all times. You know, when I signed up to go to Mars, I never realized that we would be weightless for the whole goddamn trip. As an Arkansas farmer, this is a little weird. I wonder what's going to happen to the 15,000 hens I've parked in the cargo bay. They probably never lay another egg. He extended his hand to Kenji and introduced himself as Max Puckett. Kenji introduced himself. "I'm the colony historian," he explained. "My wife, Nai, is a teacher." "Damn," said Max Puckett. "I was hoping you were one of the farming couples from Vietnam or Laos. I want to learn something about rice."
"Did I hear you say something about hens?" Nai asked. "Are there chickens here on the Pinta?"
"Passengers only occupy 20% of the space on the Pinta and the Santa Maria," Kenji reminded her. "Supplies and other cargo take up the remainder of the space. Here on the Pinta, we have a total of 300 passengers, most of them International Space Agency officials and other key personnel necessary to initialize the colony on Mars."
"Initialize?" Max interrupted.
Kenji laughed. "I guess I do use a lot of ISA jargon. I was one of the first civilians selected for the colony, and I managed recruiting in Asia."
"Well, since you know so much, where's all those convict women I saw on television?" Max asked with a twinkle. "Woo-wee, some of them were mighty fine."
"All the colonists who had been held in detention on Earth will be traveling on the Santa Maria," Kenji said. "We arrive on Mars about 2 months before them. As you must have heard, we had some difficulty with recruitment. That's why convicts were accepted, in exchange for full pardons and freedom when they return to Earth in 5 years.
"There's no need to worry," he said, turning to Nai. "They're going to be full citizens of the colony, like everyone else. They all had perfect records during their times in detention."
The door to the lounge opened, and an elderly gentleman entered and introduced himself as Pyotr Mishkin.
"Glad to know you, Peter," Max said, sticking out his hand. "I'm Max."
"Mr. Max," Pyotr Mishkin said formally.
"My first name is Pyotr, not Peter. It is bad enough that I must speak English. Surely I can ask that my name at least retain its original Russian sound."
"Okay, Pyotr," Max said. "What do you do anyway? No, let me guess. You're the colony undertaker."
For a fraction of a second, Kenji was afraid that Mr. Mishkin was going to explode in anger. Instead, the smallest of smiles began to form upon his face.
"It is apparent, Mr. Max, that you have a certain comic gift. But for your information, I am not the undertaker. I was trained in the law. Until 2 years ago, when I retired, I was a member of the Soviet Supreme Court."
Most of the world was watching on television when the Pinta was formally dedicated several hours before it was scheduled to depart Earth's orbit and head for its official destination. The second vice president of the Council of Governments gave a short address to commemorate the opening of what he called a new era of Martian colonization. And then Mr. Ian McMillan, the commander of the Pinta and perhaps the quintessential ISA bureaucrat, read a speech reminding the world of the fundamental objectives of the project.